are coming, the drought from coming everywhere. So prepare, say a prayer, send the word to beware. We'll be over, we're coming over, and we won't come back till it's over, over there. So gorgeous was the spectacle on the May morning of 1910, when nine kings rode in the funeral of Edward VII of England, that the crowd waiting in hushed and black-clad awe could not keep back gasps of admiration. In scarlet and blue and green and purple, three by three the sovereigns rode through the palace gates. With plumed helmets, gold braid, crimson sashes, and jeweled orders flashing in the sun. And after them came five heirs apparent, 40 more imperial or royal highnesses, 7 queens, 4 dowager and 3 regent, and a scattering of special ambassadors from uncrowned countries. Together they represented 70 nations in the greatest assemblage of royalty and rank ever gathered in one place and of its kind, the last. The muffled tongue of Big Ben told 9 by the clock as the cortege left the palace. But on history's clock, it was sunset. And the sun of the old world was setting in a dying blaze of splendor, never to be seen again. Barbara Tuchman, In the Guns of August. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. We're on the road today, coming to you from the Talbot County Free Library in Easton, Maryland. Sunday, November 11, 2 weeks from now, will mark the 100th anniversary of the signing of the armistice in Compiègne, France, ending the First World War. There are a number of world events one could cite that have had a major impact on human history. The French Revolution, the Enlightenment, the invention of the printing press, are a few. The First World War is undoubtedly one of the most significant of the 20th century. As Tuchman says, it truly marked the end of the old world order. On the political side, for example, it resulted in the fall of 4 monarchies and contributed to the Bolshevik rise to power in Russia in 1917. The days of kings and queens was indeed over. It also marked a shattering of confidence in the way we saw ourselves and our place in the world. Glory and honor, words spoken without embarrassment in the old order, were left on the battlefield, where death was impersonal and indiscriminate for the 9 million soldiers, sailors, and flyers it took. To this number can be added the approximately 5 million civilians killed. Finally, the end of the old order was also marked by a grand state of disillusion. The security of the future and our place as its author had never come more under question. At the dawn of the 20th century, no one expected a war of this magnitude or duration. It all started with carrier pigeons for communication and horses for transport. It ended with tanks, trucks, submarines, airplanes for reconnaissance and bombing, machine guns, and poison gas. The sun had set on the old world order, and confidence in the future was shattered by a war no one wanted, a war that ultimately bled into the horrors of the Second World War. Life isn't so sweet as it used to be. An American in the Great War is a compilation of the letters, recollections, and poetry of Senator Millard E. Tydings, covering his time as a soldier in the First World War. The book was compiled and edited by his niece, Mary E. Campbell, and her son, John S. Campbell. Mary and John are my guests today on Delmarva Today Writers Edition. Mary and John, welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
It's good to be here, Hal.
It's wonderful.
Mary, tell us a little something about yourself. And then, John, I'll ask you to do the same.
All right. You said a while ago that this war, the First World War, bled into a war that ultimately became the horror of the Second World War. And that is really my earliest memories are the Second World War. I was a child. I lived on an army post in New York on Governor's Island. And I remember the blackout shades as a young child. I remember the air warden who would go around and check. I remember the plane spotters who had their little books of planes. And all of it was very scary to a 4 or 5 year old. My father was in charge of the Italian prisoners of war. Many of them lived with us. They all had these black armbands that said POW on them. So war, because that I was so young and it was so scary, has always kind of interested me kind of in an emotional way. That aside, I grew up, I think, pretty normally, and was a teacher at a school in Bethesda, Maryland, and a school administrator.
What did you teach, Mary?
I taught elementary school, particularly reading or literature and social studies and some science. And as I say, I had three children. I have 7 grandchildren. And I have retired over here to the Eastern Shore with my husband, where we enjoy every day. My family, certainly on my mother's side, comes from the Bay Area, Haverty Grace, where my uncle and my mother grew up. So,
John,
yeah,
tell us a bit about yourself.
All right. I obviously am my mother's child, so I grew up in Maryland also. I am currently the chairman of the history department at St. Albans School in Washington, D.C. And I live actually at a boarding school in McLean, Virginia, called the Madeira School, where my wife works. I've enjoyed teaching all sorts of things, but my area of particular interest is 19th century European history. And the Romantic Age in particular, but I've also studied and dabbled in medieval literature.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, life isn't so sweet as it used to be, is the book you put together, Mary, of your uncle's writings. Would you and John, but beginning with you, Mary, tell us a bit about this book and how you came to write it.
Well,
or rather, to put it together,
right, because there's not a word in it that is written by either John or myself, other than maybe some headings of different divisions in the book.
Well, you organize, and that's a job, and
right.
And also I think you wrote a wonderful introduction.
Oh, well, thank you.
Well,
as I say in the introduction, my mother had among her treasures the letters that her brother, Millard Tydings, wrote to his mother from training camp. There were quite a few from training camp, and then they peter out a little bit as communications got harder once he went to war in France. And so she loved these letters, and she left them to me. And John says he is a history teacher, loved kind of finding out about how things happened, why they happened, when they happened, and he took a particular interest in them. I had kind of toyed with the idea of just putting the letters together in a little book for the family to read. And I think I must have mentioned this to John, and I'm going to let John take it from there, because that's what happened. John took it from there to a large extent.
Yeah, attics are a place I generally love to explore, and my mother had showed me these letters from her uncle. I thought they were fascinating. She wanted to put some sort of book for the family together, and I began looking around for maybe some illustrations that might accompany such a book. And as I was doing some research, I found out that Millard Tidings had in fact written a book, The Machine Gunners of the Blue and Gray. And as I researched more into that, I realized that the Hornbake Library at the University of Maryland had files of his papers. So I thought I'd just go and check those out. And I remember talking to my mother excitedly after that experience, because I found in those files all sorts of recollections that he had about his experience in the war, and poems that he had written, which I thought were absolutely fabulous, as well as photographs that either he had taken or had been taken of the ship he went across the water on. So it was just a wonderful experience to go to this library and find all these different things. And there was even a play called A Barren Victory that he had written. But we took the really what was there, which were the photographs, the poems, the recollections, and then combined them with the letters to create this book.
Well, tell us a little bit about the structure of the book. Well, I mean, here you've got all these poems, you've got this other book about the machine gunners and the war, and you've got recollections as well. So you've got three or four stacks of work here to combine.
It was intimidating.
Well, you had to think about some structure that you wanted.
Right.
How did you do that?
We came up with doing it chronologically. It made sense in terms of the history. And it also made sense in terms of the man, where he began and where he ended, and the movement through that. And so that's really how we structured it. Then we broke it down into smaller pieces, but always chronologically, where the battle happened to be taking place, where the action. The first one is getting ready. He was in training camp in Alabama. So there's some text from that. And always we were weaving in the poems. And the poems really kind of helped us figure out where they belonged, because they just fit. The story of the poem or the emotion of the poem fit the text. And then Alsace, and then the Meuse-Argonne, and then, so that was really how we divided it up. And we would put the letters where they belonged, we thought, the poetry where it seemed appropriate, and often it was very appropriate. And then we would weave we had the text of the book, and then we had this typewritten text that were his recollections. And he, I believe, wrote those recollections, and John helped me with this, really quite quickly after the war was over.
And they sound very karmic.
And that's the thing, because I think if you look at the verb tenses, in fact, he's probably drawing from his journals when he's writing these recollections, because a lot of them he's talking as if he were there at the time. It wasn't looking back, it was experiencing it at the time. So these recollections, I believe, are things that he's drawn from journals that he kept during the war and then perhaps added some ideas onto them.
Well, that seems to be apparent, because also you get the emotional content. A lot of times the emotional content can be lost after a period of time, but these, again, I use the word current.
Mm-hmm.
These, again, sounded very current.
Right.
John, as a historian, mm-hmm. when you looked at all these papers, were you intimidated by the amount of work you all of a sudden realized you had?
Well, happily, my mother was there, really, because she was the one who sort of organized it overall. But it was, I mean, all we really had in terms of dates that were clear were the dates on the letters. You could then attach, because we knew history, the recollections to certain times. The poems were things that we looked at, and they didn't have a date attached to them. We knew he was writing poetry because he said in one of the letters to his mother, "I'm writing poetry. I think it's actually not too bad, and you know, my comrades tell me that it's pretty good, so maybe I'll do something with it." So we know he's writing poetry during the course of his experience, and it was really fun sort of overlaying the poetry then on the letters and the recollections, and then filling in the gaps with the thing that he had already published, this Machine Gunners of the Blue and Gray.
Well, John, I guess you might be the one. Read us one of these early letters.
Sure.
So that we can, as we talk about the book, we can get that little flavor of his writing.
Absolutely. Okay, so the letter I'd like to read then is a letter that he wrote on, that's postmarked May 14th, 1918. Which was, and he's written this to his mother. So
he's in training camp.
He's in training camp.
He went over in June, if I remember correctly.
That's absolutely right. So this is May. He's at Camp McClellan in Anniston, Alabama. And he's written at the top of the letter, Monday PM. And it says, "Dear Mother, yesterday was Mother's Day, and I thought of you back home and how I would have liked to have spent the day with you. It was a beautiful day down here, and everywhere both men and women wore flowers in honor of the occasion. Mother, I am surely in fine physical condition. I have never had the energy and strength before that I have now. This kind of life in the open makes men out of us all, for the exercise and regularity of everything is a wonderful, healthful tonic. Before I go over to the other side, I'm hoping to be able to spend a day or so with you, and I think I shall be able to do so. I surely do want to get over with all my heart. All the men are simply wild to go. I am proud of the men in my company. They are a fine lot of fellows and will give a good account of themselves later on. The time has come to take the great adventure, and I can truthfully say that I have not the slightest fear of the future. I shall come back, I feel sure, and I cannot help but believe I shall make good over there. Within a month, I shall be far from here and most likely over there. All such information must be kept absolutely within our family and under no circumstances whatever be imparted either directly or indirectly to any person whatever. When I think of the 500,000 fellows over there, I surely do feel proud to be able to take my place among them. I was talking to a mother of a soldier Saturday whose son is an aviator in France, where he has been for 7 months. She was so proud and happy to think she had a son there. Mother, the men who are going over to France are going to be the real men of the country later on. They will be our statesmen and will be in the forefront of all worthy achievements. After all, what is life worthwhile that leads a humdrum existence without sensing all the wonderful experiences that one must have over there? The old school chums shall meet, men, real men, who through other days look for pleasures of dances, parties, etc., but who, when the time comes, are still ready to get into the greatest game in the world's history."
Game.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I found it interesting that before it starts off as a game, and that continues to some degree. But tell us a little bit about who is the man who wrote this letter. Who is this man?
At this time, or and just no, in general?
This, no, at this time.
At
Who
this
is this
time.
Man at this time? You know, he says later on, I'll give you a hint from my thinking, right? He says later on, boys playing at war.
Mm-hmm.
Boys playing at war.
Right.
And closer to the end, I'll ask you the same question about who that man is at the end of this book. Who
right.
is this man? This boy playing
this boy.
At war.
This boy playing at war. He had been elected to the House of Delegates in Maryland. He had gotten a law degree. He had also, and John has to help me with this, served in the Mexican.
He was down in Mexico with Pancho Villa, I believe, you know, that whole episode, which
yeah.
seems like it was more of a lark. In terms of
it's mentioned.
Right. And this was I think a fun experience, basically.
But
that he
was an accomplished man.
He grew up in the small town of Haverty Grace, where his family had lived for a number of generations. His father was an engineer. His father, just to get into the family a little bit, because I think it helps define who he is, I think he and the sisters felt that the father had not really was doing right by their mother. They deeply loved their mother. They were all very, I would say, Irish in a great sense of the word. Loved to have a good time, laugh and tell stories and sing and love music. And the father wasn't quite on board with all of that. He was a little more dour. And he also spent a lot of time at the Haverty Grace racetrack, which was a big racetrack in Maryland at the time, and he drank a bit. So he, I think, and he was the oldest child. My mother was 17 years younger than he was. My aunt was 10 years younger. So he kind of was used to kind of taking charge and stepping up. And I think you're beginning to see that he really enlists as a private. And within about a year and a half, he's a colonel.
Yeah.
And that's really a fast move. And there's...
Well, as I say, you just from that letter, and from what you've said, Mary, you get the sense that he was an accomplished man
right.
when he went. And there's really nothing maudlin relative to the mother-son relationship in any of these letters.
No, and he was accomplished. At the same time, I think he goes into the war as an innocent. I mean, and he is somewhat... that's exactly it. I think, you know, the generation of young men had been raised on sort of the classical literature at the time, and war was something different. I think they imagined war being something different than it turned out to be. And so he does have these, you know, this is the greatest game. You know, we're going to go over there and make a good show. It's really a different kind of language at the beginning than we see at the end.
Well, the sense was that this war, in fact, was different.
Yeah.
It was very different.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Than what anyone had experienced before. Mary, did you know your uncle?
Yes, I did. My mother grew up in Haverty Grace. Her sister lived there all of her life, and my uncle had his home there. So we would spend a couple weeks in the summer up there. At Christmas, we'd always get together. And of course, I grew up in Washington suburbs. He was in the Senate, and so he was in Washington when the Senate was in session. And he and his sister, even though they were 17 years apart, as I say, just really kind of gravitated towards each other. They were kind of two of a kind.
Is the Catherine mentioned?
The Catherine is my mother. And this Payne, Mr. Whatever his name is, asking his mother to make sure, that's her piano teacher.
Right, no, I'm not struck by that.
He really really wanted to make sure that she took it, and she was very musical. She played by ear. She went to Peabody. She was very.
And I remember that her piano playing was remarkable. She loved to play Rachmaninoff or all these sort of romantic things she would play on the.
And furthermore, she could do it with an orange.
So she
one hand would be playing with the orange, and the other hand would be doing the other, and it was. You know, she was...
She's character.
She could be the life of the party.
Well, he mentions that. He mentions to make sure that Catherine keeps up with her,
right,
with her piano playing. There are three things in these letters that go through all of the letters that I found really, really interesting. One was make sure Catherine practices. It's very important. Went on. The other is that life insurance policy, right?
Yeah.
Coming back.
Yeah, that's
to
true.
That life.
Well, he was going to war.
Yeah. I mean, that's and that's serious business.
Taking the money out of his account was very important.
I thought you were going to mention the boat.
The one that struck me.
Yeah. Sell that boat.
A lot of people here on the Eastern Shore is please. Right. Sell that boat.
Sell the boat.
You sell the boat.
Right.
I mean, the bullets are flying overhead, and he's writing to his mother.
Right.
And he's saying, did you sell the boat?
Right. Absolutely.
Did you sell the boat? I'm willing to take a loss.
That's right.
I just don't want it rotting on the shore.
No, I think that's excellent. That was a funny undercurrent. The life insurance thing really is quite telling because he's very reassuring with his mother about how he's eating well and he's in great shape and the whole thing.
He's gained weight.
He's gained weight. He's never been better. But let's make sure the life insurance is okay, too. I mean, so there's that acknowledgement.
Well, of course. Yeah. It seems to me that, again, he was a very solid person.
Mm-hmm.
Even when he went in to the service, and you mentioned, John, earlier about the poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Would you read one of the one of his early poems to us, or at least a portion of one of the early poems? Let us get a flavor of
it. So this one is called "The Gallows Steps of War," and he is at this point over in France. He has gone through an officer training about machine gun. Operating the machine gun, these machine guns they're going to be using.
John, do you have a sense of why he became a machine gunner or wanted to enter that area of the service?
Well, I do think he was someone who had his eye to the future all the time, and I think he realized that this gun was the change agent on the battlefield. You know, he does show throughout the story a fascination with the planes. He goes up in a plane and has this memorable moment up in a plane. He gets strafed by a plane. But it's, I think, the machine guns and the respect for the German machine gunners that he mentions. But there's something about the machine gun. He realizes that this is going to be the instrument on the battlefield that's going to turn the tide, that's wholly different from anything in the way of,
So he was trained as an engineer.
Mm.
His college degree was in engineering, and I think he went out and was an engineer for a year and found it not very satisfying, and then turned around and went to law school.
And there is a technical aspect. In the Hornbeck Library, you can find his notebooks from this time at the machine gun school, effectively. And it's got all these diagrams and how you live fire over certain areas. And it is all very technical, and he's obviously, I think, quite inclined towards that. So he'd gone to this school in Alsace, and this particular poem comes from, when he talks about the graduates, he means the fellow soldiers who have been through this program with him, and they are now taking a train to the front. And he makes comments here about playing craps or crap, mm-hmm. And so that's some of the jargon that's used in this as well. So this is called "The Gallows Steps of War." So the graduates pushed into the cars, and many a jest was spoke, for some of them were marked for death. Perhaps these sensed a joke. And dice and cards and dice, and shoot and craps and sevens, and point and joe and faded now and tens and twelves and elevens. Dice take a soldier's mind off war and hell and death and heaven, and tinge his stark barbaric thoughts with this more alluring leaven. So, the engine coughed deep-throatedly, and the train clanked o'er the rails, and here some spun a lurid joke, and there some told a tale. But none of them could know the yarn in which they'd play a part, being fabricated then by fate, and now just at its start, that tell of cheers and fears and tears, and of bullets through the heart, of rotting guts and ill-starred luck, and rats and lice and thirst, and tucked away in all their thoughts, whom death would beckon first. And craps and joes and natural rolled out upon the floor, the cleric song to marked men on the gallows steps of war.
Who is this man, John, do you think? How has he changed since that first letter to his mother?
Well, you know, I think he has at least now firsthand stories of what's happening at the front. And
he's not been there yet.
He's not been there yet, but he I think, now has a better understanding now that he's in France than he did when he was in Anniston.
And he's being trained to kill.
He has. I mean, he is now, he's about to be put in the front lines to do.
It's a little more abstract, though.
It is. Yeah. No, certainly. I mean, and at the end, you know, there's another poem at the end where I think it's abstract in another sense, but it's taken a turn. But this is much more, I mean, sort of the Wilfred Owen type poem at the towards the beginning of his experience, you know, the famous British poet, where it's, you know, this is what we're going to do. We're thinking about death, but here we go. And, you know, and this is how we're distracting ourselves, is with the card games and the dice. But we're off without an understanding, really, of what they're off to.
John, give us a little context of the war, mm-hmm. if you can. Where is he going? What is happening here? What's he going into? I mean, this is 1918
mm-hmm.
now. This is 1918. The war is going to wind down in a bit. What is he going into?
So, I mean, sort of in the grand scheme of things, he's going into what is going to be the greatest U.S. campaign of all time in terms of this Meuse-Argonne offensive. What has happened at this point is that, you know, the Russians have pulled out of the war. They've convulsed into a revolution, and the Germans have now been able to take their troops from the Eastern Front and put them on the Western Front. So they are hoping to finish this thing before the Americans really get established.
Where is the line? Is it at the Meuse?
Yeah, it's at the Meuse. And so, and slowly, the Americans actually have been pushing them back, but the Germans seem unbreakable at this point. They're in France. And in fact, you know, the war ends, the armistice is signed, there are no foreign troops in Germany. So, I mean, and that's why this helps, you know, feed into the what's called the Dolchstoss legenda, that the Germans were stabbed in the back. This is something that the Nazis will play upon. But at this point, this, you know, the Meuse-Argonne is the major offensive. It was in October of 1918, so the centennial is now for this amazing enterprise. And he knew that he was going to be a part of what was going to be the breakthrough battle. I mean, this was the make-or-break battle. Pershing almost lost his mind over this one. I mean, they were throwing men over the top. They had machine guns to protect them, obviously heavy artillery, but this was the make or break battle in October 1918, and they drove the Germans to the peace table.
And he is going into this battle now, into this war, mm-hmm. as it were. And what happened to him? Tell me what do you say in the book that happened to him?
Well, you know, he experiences the war firsthand. He sees the horror of modern technology, of which he is a part, and what it does to young men's bodies. And he sees this firsthand. It's no longer an abstraction for him. He walks up and down the trenches. He sees men who are fearful. He experiences gas attacks.
He gets gassed.
The men are living effectively underground. I mean, it really is a bizarre existence. They have dug themselves into the earth, and that's where their existence, you know, lies. And he has these machine guns, which again make all the difference. And yet, there's this passage that I thought was kind of interesting about how the soldiers don't want the machine guns placed near them. There's a short passage. If I could read that one quickly, let me see.
Yeah, please do.
It's 132.
Yeah. So this was. This is earlier. Yeah. It says, orders came to harass the German positions with machine gun fire at least 6 times each 24 hours. It was highly exciting work. The men liked to be engaged in it. Each of the two harassing platoons fired on enemy lines 3 times each day, usually twice at night and once in daylight. 1,000 bullets were used for each firing, or 250 to a gun. To shoot these rapid-fire fashion required only about a minute. When the firing was over, the problem was to get at once under cover. The infantrymen in these lines never wanted us to fire from positions near them. They knew that Germans would try to put the machine guns out of action. As we looked about for a good place to locate our guns, we would nearly always be yelled at, "Don't you put those goddamn guns here!" It was the same every place. Of course, no attention was paid to these ordered requests. After all, the machine gunners were taking the great risk, for they were on top of the ground when firing. "Take those damn guns away from here!" "Where would you have us put them?" "I don't care a damn where you put them. Just take them away from here. You want the hell shot out of us? Well, won't we be here with you when it happens? Why don't you go someplace else with them?" "That's a good suggestion. Shall we carry them over to the German trenches and shoot them from there?" This happened dozens of times.
Tell us, John, about the machine gun itself and the placement and the way they designed the firing of the guns. Your book goes into Tidings goes into great detail, in fact, about the nature of his work.
Mm-hmm.
If you would.
Yeah, one of the things the placement of the guns are absolutely key. They have to be hidden. Because as soon as the gunfire breaks out, as he's made mention here, it gets all the attention from the enemy. And so they go to elaborate lengths to disguise where the guns are, to keep the guns from overheating. They've got water canisters attached to them.
So there's a water jacket around the barrel?
Exactly. Yes, there's a water jacket around.
Took 4 to 6 men to operate one of these.
That's right.
And set it up. They had to haul water.
They did. They had to haul water. I mean, there was a lot of production to go into it. It was one of the more interesting things to find. He had a, he drew, and I guess he was a decent artist at some level too, Tidings. He drew a picture of one of the machine gun placements. Let me see, I can't remember what page that's on. But anyway, yeah, so they would hang burlap across an area that was fairly wooded, and then they would cut a hole in the burlap. They'd wet the burlap so that wouldn't catch fire, because these guns would get tremendously hot. They'd you know, fire, as they say, in short bursts, and then they'd have to dismantle it and get it out of there, because it would then be the object of artillery fire. It obviously made a huge difference. What they do is, I mean, there was this no man's land, and which was the area between the two trenches, and the machine guns were absolutely essential in maintaining the trench where it was, because if any enemy came across, well, rifle fire could potentially stop them, but if they came over en masse, then it was really the machine gun that would have to stop them, and did. And as you know. Thousands
well,
of men were killed.
In advance, they had to fire over
and that's,
their own troops
right.
to protect them to some degree.
So at the end of this this account, there's a battle at Etre Ridge, which is part of the Meuse Argonne campaign. And what Tidings did, which was innovative, was he designed a system by which he would fire over the heads of advancing troops. And up in the higher echelons of command, they basically forbade him to do this. They thought it was too risky. But he got his immediate superior to go along with it for this one particular attack, knowing that there would be a huge loss of men if they didn't try this. And so with marker flags, the men would advance. The machine gunners would, under Tidings' command, would put just an enormous barrage over their heads that would land about 100, 150 yards in front of them and clear a path. And then when they see that the men reached a certain point, they'd stop and they'd readjust the guns. There'd be sort of a couple minutes pause, and then the men would advance again and they'd fire over their heads again, this time another 100 yards down. And they advanced and took Etre Ridge with this tactic. A tactic that was so successful that it then became part of training of machine gunners at West Point. It became part of the basic curriculum, was this method that Tidings used at Etre Ridge.
It's very technical. It's a very gruesome piece of work, but it's a very technical piece of work as well. And also, we tend to forget that that kind of rapid fire was brand new.
Yes.
I mean, this had not been used in war before.
And clearly the tactics that were being used against the machine gun had not caught up to the technology itself.
Well, that was one of the big problems of the war, wasn't it?
Exactly right.
I mean, we always fight the last war.
That's exactly right.
And to some degree, we fought the poor British, for instance, at the Battle of the Somme, lost 60,000 men in one day.
That's right.
And we fight the last war, and we did to some degree with this war, except people began to catch on quickly.
They did. The French had particular difficulties with it. Men stopped going up over the top in 1915-16, and the French solution was, though, to court-martial and shoot men who wouldn't go up over the top. So, you know, you were faced as a soldier, you either go up over the top or you're going to die anyway because of insubordination. So the tactics, they did start to adjust, but still, even at the end of the war, the United States, they were throwing men in large numbers at machine gun nests. There was artillery, hopefully, that you had coordinated with, and sometimes, as we saw, that didn't work right. And then
170,000 men in a year and a half.
Yeah, I mean, just
it looked like a little bit more that we lost. We were in the war again, as I said, I think, John, about a year and a half, maybe a little bit more than that. What was the significant role that Tidings and the American forces played in that war?
Well, at a very basic level, there was an emotional aspect to it. The fact that the United States, with all its industrial might, was now going to support the Allies against the Germans. You see Tidings and others saying, this is going to be over. I mean, it may take a while, but the tide has turned. As soon as the United States enters into this is going to be a victory. It's just a matter of how long. And he does get discouraged, and the men get discouraged, and they wonder how long it's going to, in fact, be. But I think the psychological impact, as well as obviously the technological impact of having the U.S. troops over there, was, I mean, it's what turned the tide of the war. So.
Yeah, the Germans were starving to death, I understand. The French were just, and the British to some degree, were just basically worn out.
That's
and,
right.
And the Americans came in to pick up.
There's a neat, can I read you a brief passage just about his experience? Because I do love his writing. I think it's terrific. He says, this is sometime in October 1918, they say the Germans are weakening. Well, they may be, but no one is walking across no man's land to ask them if it's true. Latrine gossip, bull to keep up the men's spirits. Is there any person who can stop this war decently? If so, I can't think of one. No matter which side wins, it will have spent more in life and treasure than it can possibly get out of it. Then why continue it? Why start in it at all when the winner is bound to be a loser? Such thoughts won't help any. I think of the United States. What are they doing over there? Let's see, it's 9 o'clock here. That means 4 o'clock afternoon in New York. I visualize large crowds at the seashore. They are bathing, laughing, dancing as we stand here in the trench with death about the parapet. Beach strollers move up and down. There will be chaps splashing water on flirtatious women. Others are in the mountains for the summer. There will be complaints about the flies and mosquitoes. All life is comparative. Little luxuries to some are big luxuries for others. Here I don't mind too much the lice or the rat's tails running over my face at night. I'm glad to have a hole in the ground. It's my castle. The people back home will never understand or correctly imagine this war as it is over here. Seems fairly quiet. I think I'll turn into my hole in the ground for sleep. So ran my thoughts. I stretch out on my bunk, placing my gas mask where it can be found quickly.
Mary and John, tell us about the progression of this man. I as I read the book, I found four stages of progression. You may well have seen others. You read the letter, John, of Tidings to his mother when he was in training camp, and that poem. Perhaps to show a bit of the progression, you might read one of the later poems to give us a sense of how he had changed.
Sure. The one that's most striking is this Thoughts of a Madman. And this is, it's a different even kind of writing. I mean, there's the rhyming and sort of the straightforward, bold poetry of at the beginning. And then at the end, you have this almost stream of consciousness, Thoughts of a Madman.
It's kind of fallen apart.
It is.
The structure has kind of fallen apart. The structure has kind of fallen apart in his poetry, and it reflects his state of mind.
Read it for us.
And yeah. In fact, just for a second, he had just been, at least in the narrative, in a situation where they were just pounded in a ravine. He and two other soldiers got caught there. And one of them, that after half an hour of the pounding and the horror of it all, lost it and said, "I'm going mad." And he burst into tears and sobbing. They all hugged him. And this, to me, reflects the moment that fellow felt, and they were all feeling.
Yeah, absolutely right. The heavy artillery was another of those innovations of World War I, these enormous artillery barrages that I think you can't imagine what it was like to be at the receiving end of that and how destructive it was to one's psyche. And as my mother said, one of these men fell apart. There is one sense and only one, not more. We see, hear, taste, smell, and touch with the fibers of the heart. Few live long, but it's a riotous existence. Many are born who live not even a minute, though moving here past fourscore year in idle ambulation. Some live longer in but a single second than time itself, while many living are dead. I like a bit of savagery. All men do, but so few come to know it. The hand may send a rhapsody of sweet delight with but the faintest touch. Hands can make music without a single instrument on which to ply a note. There he was in all the muck and half disclosed. I had to run him through. Poor fellow, he had such a look of pity in his eyes. Bones, nothing but their bleaching in the sun. My God, this bombardment is exquisite. The shrieks are most exotic in the ear, but the viol knows how to juggle them to tune. Think of the joy of voyaging with a shell through the sweet air of the heavens and to crash upon some happy hearth with such effusion in the greeting. One must be mobile to gain admittance. Statues never embraced a woman. I mean, I think this is a man who is, in common parlance, is suffering post-traumatic stress.
And I think many things point to the fact that all of this writing he did is what kept him from being brought under by post-traumatic stress. I mean, even 20 years later, he wrote this play called Barren Victory. It's not a great play, but it's still, he is still working through the whole thing. He worked through it in the book that he published. He worked through it in the recollections that he did. He certainly worked through it in the poetry. And I think that helped him deal with it and let him become a functioning, effective person.
To make the change,
mm-hmm.
To make the change back.
Right.
Again.
But I think he lived with it, though. I don't think it ever was erased in his mind. I think he just dealt with it by talking about it and thinking about it. He did not submerge it. He did not repress it and suffer all the problems that happen when you repress something that needs attention.
And I think that is actually, he's on the cutting edge there, because at this time they are experimenting with the talking cure, that psychoanalysts are dealing with people like Wilfred Owen and Siegfried Sassoon, officers who have undergone and experienced shell shock and are talking their way back into
shell shock was the word.
That was the word. And talking themselves back into health. And he's not talking to any analyst, but he is putting his narrative out there. He's putting it on paper. He's engaging in a dialogue with himself, and in writing it out there and sharing his poetry, he's going through this talking cure.
What kind of person was he, Mary, after the war? He did the writing and so forth, but he went on to very significant accomplishments.
Right, he came back and he rejoined the House of Delegates. He was almost immediately elected Speaker of the House of Delegates. I think probably, I don't know now, but for a long time, the youngest Speaker of the House of Delegates there was. And then he had a term in the House of Representatives, and then he had four terms in the Senate. And one of the big things that he was very much for nuclear disarmament, and I think that is born of this.
Well, he was active in the McCarthy era.
He was very active. He was chairman of a Armed Services Committee that was tasked with investigating McCarthy's charges that there were communists in the army, and he did. And he found no evidence that there were communists in the army. And it made McCarthy mad to be undercut that way. And McCarthy really fought to have him, lose his upcoming election. And interestingly enough, in one of the things in the election was shortly before election day, what was circulated was a picture of my uncle, and he's kind of leaning forward smiling with his hand on his chin, and he's smiling, and on the right next to him is Earl Browder, who was chairman of the Communist Party, and he is leaning forward and smiling, and that was circulated around. And for that reason, and probably there were others too, he'd served four terms. I'm sure he, you know, had done votes that weren't totally satisfactory all the time to Marylanders, but that was a big thing. They really were out to get him, and they did. And then Life magazine, about 6 weeks later, had discovered the two separate photos that they pasted together. So, you know, and I think that really upset him. He went back to his farm, wanted to run again, filed, and then got shingles. Mm. And the shingles was in his eye and kind of went into his head.
But that was something. I mean, he's obviously a deeply patriotic man, and I do think that experience with McCarthy shook him, and the fact that it unseated him with these tactics that McCarthy used, I think probably was shaking to his foundation about the country.
Right.
I think that one of the things that interests me relative to his career coming home from from the military, and in having such a distinguished career as a statesman and a senator, is his ability, and you say that and it's through writing, his ability to make the adjustment back to civilian life, or to a life without without war, because we can see in the two poems that's a very different man came home than the man who went. I when I was looking for the transition, I saw first, and you can correct me on this. I saw first boys going to war. The war is a game. We're anxious to get over there. And then another comment. In which he says the war took on a business-like aspect, that he just fell into the routine and the mechanism of doing what he had to do. And then the third transition I saw was more of a cynical, a little bit. There isn't a lot of cynicism in this book, quite frankly, not a lot. But the one passage that I saw on page 223 was simply the sentence, "I'm to live for two things: first, to kill; second, to be rewarded for killing." And that's after saying that the thing itself is not enough. You want people to praise you for the thing that you did. And then my last little transition that I saw in there was, I think, what comes over perhaps a lot of soldiers, even though I've never had the experience, is a bit of indifference. Well, if they kill me, they kill me. Mm. Well, and I'm just gonna keep doing what I'm doing.
With always, though, moments that shake him. For instance, when you have the kitchen that's bombarded by the artillery and the dead horses, and he sees these dead horses, and he's like, how come these animals are affecting me so deeply? I'm surrounded by dead men, and yet the sight of these innocent horses is completely undoing. And so I think you're right, he does get into the business of war, but he is shaken out of it just by experiences.
Well, the indiscriminate nature, the horses don't have a choice. He had a choice.
Yep. Right. And that's what he says, yeah. Right.
But also, he's always, in times of stress and killing, wondering about the Germans. Well, what are their mothers feeling about all this?
Yep.
Or, you know, they have friends, and at this very tense, I think probably the scariest moment that he writes about, when they're being bombarded and his friend loses it and says, "I'm going mad," he says, "But the Germans are my brother." Hmm. So I don't think he totally flips that they're bad and and I'm good.
He continues to wrestle.
He continues to wrestle with it. I don't think he loses, at least not for long, the idea that these people are men, people, humans.
Yeah.
Well, Mary and John, thank you.
Well, thank you.
For bringing this wonderful book to us. Where can people get it, Mary?
On Amazon.
Okay, good.
And the title is a little tricky. It's Life Isn't So Sweet As It Used To Be, which is a kind of the diction of the time, of 100 years ago.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.